And this is Peter Schiff here at SchiffRadio.com. And joining the show now is Vern McKinley. Vern is the author of the just-released Financing Failure, A Century of Bailouts. He's a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's also served as a legal advisor and regulatory policy expert for governments on financial sector issues in the U.S., China, and around the world. He's also testified before Congress and worked with the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, FDIC, U.S. Treasury Department, and other institutions. And like me, he was one of the early critics of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae, calling them financial time bombs, and they sure did explode. Vern, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
Good morning, Peter. Thanks for the invitation.
And thanks for coming on. So a century of bailouts? You're telling me that we were bailing companies out 100 years ago?
Well, specifically banks. I dug back as far as the First World War, and there was an entity called the War Finance Corporation that was created during the war to help out weaker banks, and the Fed existed at that time, but for the institutions that weren't in good enough shape for the, qualifying for the Fed's loans from the discount window, there was this War Finance Corporation that was around to bail them out.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the whole FDIC, you know, the introduction of that was a kind of way to try to help bail out the banks. I mean, people think that that was all about the depositors. It wasn't. It was about keeping the banks so that the depositors wouldn't worry about whether or not their money was there, so that the banks could lend out a lot more money than they might otherwise be able to lend in a free market.
Right. I mean, it was intended for financial stability purposes. The money stock, as you well know, dropped about a third there from about 1929 to 1931, and the idea was that you give them a guarantee so that they keep their money in the banks as opposed to putting it in the mattress. And the ratio of deposits to currency, I think, is a pretty good indicator of that. It dropped pretty dramatically during those years.
Yeah, although I think they, you know, I guess if you actually look at the amount of money that was lost, I think it was less than 2% of deposits that were actually lost to all the bank failures, which, you know, we lost more than that this year alone due to inflation. You know, inflation was more than 2%, so, you know, people are doing worse as far as the losses under deposits with the FDIC than they did during the Great Depression without it. But, you know, so what are the...
Sorry.
What are the other big bailouts? I mean, I always think about the Chrysler bailout as one of the first, you know, really big ones where we guaranteed their debt back in, I think, 1979. But, I mean, are there other ones that were like that prior to Chrysler?
Well, in the book in particular, I focus on bank and financial institution bailouts. So I trace through the War Finance Corporation, as I mentioned, and the next big one was the RFC, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, that was a broad-based program, kind of like TARP back in the 1930s. And then in the 70s was Franklin National Bank. That was a big New York bank that got into a lot of trouble. And to reverse their fortunes, they decided to play in the foreign exchange market. So they were even worse. The Fed initially lent them some discount window money, and then they eventually failed, and their depositors and foreign depositors were bailed out. And then, of course, the big one during the 80s was Continental Illinois, and everybody had all the horror stories, like we saw the most recent crisis about, okay, if Continental goes, you know, 66 banks are going to fail and another 30 or 40 are going to be at risk. And of course, that was all Chicken Little stories, similar to what we heard from Secretary Geithner and Chairman Bernanke this time around. And then, of course, you had the whole string of the bailouts during the most recent crisis, starting with Bear Stearns, and then they looked at Lehman as a possible bailout candidate but decided not to go forward with that. And then AIG, and then Wachovia, and Citigroup, and Bank of America, and then the FDIC had essentially a big bailout program called the Debt Guarantee Program. I mean, it just goes on and on, and I've tried to detail as many of those as I could in the book. As far as the policy basis, I'd have a lot of the emails in that from the Fed in particular in the book.
Yeah. Now, the government, of course, you know, likes to claim that these bailouts are a success. I mean, they're certainly already claiming that now. And, you know, we don't really know how it's all going to turn out. But they're claiming that all the bailouts following the financial crisis of 2008 were a success. In fact, even the Federal Reserve right now is making a lot of profits based on its activities. But, you know, I think they're just sowing the seeds for massive losses down the line. And I think the ultimately history is going to show that the bailouts were, in fact, a miserable failure. You know, what's your perspective on the most recent round of bailouts?
Well, if you look at TARP in particular, that was, I think that was absolutely a failure, because to sell TARP in the beginning, they scared the SH out of everybody and got everybody all worked up in all the fear-mongering that went along with that. As far as the underlying numbers and analysis of TARP, essentially we put out hundreds of billions of dollars to banks. It sat on their balance sheet, and it was never lent, which was the original intent. And then it came, most of it came back. So, I mean, it's largely a non-event. But as far as kind of the moral hazard, I think we saw a good example of that with Continental Illinois. What happened with that, and then Franklin National in the 70s and Continental in the 80s, was it essentially sent the signal that it's a good idea to get big, and because if you get big, you'll get bailed out if you have any problems. And what we saw in the 90s was enormous consolidation, and these what are called mega banks came together, whether it's Wachovia or J.P. Morgan or Citigroup, that that was the direct consequence of the incentives that were
Big, I mean, that even started. I think one of the reasons that Bank of America bought out Countrywide was because they needed to make Countrywide too big to fail. And so by rolling it into Bank of America, Countrywide was able to get a bailout through the Bank of America bailout. And, you know, they also ended up absorbing Merrill Lynch. But even, after the TARP, if you look at the consolidation, all the big banks are bigger and bigger and bigger, and the smaller ones are just going by the wayside. So, yeah, there is a huge moral hazard. But what do you think would have happened had there been no bailouts? I mean, do you think the country would have survived, or, you know, would it have been the end of the world as the politicians were telling us?
Oh, I absolutely think everything would have been fine. I mean, there would have been, you know, some people would have lost some money, some people that were not prudent enough to watch what they loaned to these banks that were undertaking pretty questionable activities. But just in general, it would have been fine. I mean, my experience, my first job out of university was in Texas during the financial crisis down there. And in 1980, if you looked at the top 10 banks there and traced them through to 1990, only one survived. And that was because the other nine, I think seven of them failed, and two were bought by out-of-state interests. So, I mean, there were cases, a case where nine banks just disappeared from the system, and, you know, everything was okay afterwards. And now you're seeing a pretty big boom in the Texas economy. It's one of the economies that's in pretty good shape now, as opposed to some of the other states. So, I mean, there's an example.
That's what,
right?
Rick Perry wants people to
yeah, there's a lot
to,
more,
but, you know,
a lot more there than Rick,
but, you know,
Perry and what he's been doing.
Yeah, well, obviously. But, you know, I disagree in that I don't think that it would have been, you know, hunky-dory had these big banks failed. I think it would have been a real shock to the system, but it would have been a shock in a positive way, in that we would have fixed a lot of the problems. And yeah, there would have been a lot of big losses. A lot of people on Wall Street and the banking sector would have lost a lot of money, but a much healthier economy would have emerged at the end of that process. And I think we would be in much better shape today, even though, you know, it would have been some bitter tasting medicine. I think there's no doubt in my mind. I think that is why our leaders, decided to do the bailouts, apart from helping out their friends who help elect them. They wanted to postpone that pain, but, you know, I believe that in doing it, the pain that they've set us up for in the very near future is going to be far more excruciating as a result of these bailouts and stimulus.
Yeah, I didn't mean to understate the pain. I mean, the example of Texas, I lived down there, and it was pretty miserable. A lot of people filed bankruptcy. A lot of businesses went out of business. You had a lot of banks, big and small, failed, but it was very short run. And Chairman Seidman of the FDIC has this phrase he calls "not on my watch" people, which refers to people that they'll, you know, pretty much do anything not to have a big failure on their watch. And that's really short-sighted, and I would definitely qualify Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke and Secretary Geithner and Chairman Baer at the FDIC. All of them were in that category. They wanted to just have the failures over with, and they didn't care what the long-term consequences were.
And, of course, you know, it was Washington policy that encouraged and financed a lot of this activity. It was the Federal Reserve that made it so cheap and profitable for speculators, both on Wall Street and Main Street. And it was Fannie and Freddie agencies that you had been warning about, too, that provided the moral hazard, that guaranteed mortgages that, but for those guarantees, never would have seen the light of day. So the government was so instrumental in this crisis and made so many mistakes in its aftermath, yet nobody in the government is getting blamed for anything. All the finger pointing is that the banks, even though they were simply doing the government's bidding. But I'll get your reaction to that and continue to talk about this topic when we return here on the Peter Schiff Show. So stick around.
The Peter Schiff Show. To President Obama, Secretary Geithner, Madam Pelosi, and all of the socialist econ professors across America, we're sorry.
We're sorry.
Peter Schiff is back on the air.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Peter Schiff here at SchiffRadio.com, talking with Vern McKinley, the author of the just-released Financial Failure or Financing Failure, A Century of Bailouts. And Vern, you know, have you spent much time looking into the Dodd-Frank bill, which I think is going to probably end up being another big disaster, which is obviously something that they were able to shove through Congress in the wake of the financial crisis?
Yeah, I've looked at it in pretty good detail. Essentially, it just codifies a lot of the ad hoc bailouts that they had during the last few years, and this idea President Obama has talked about, well, we're going to stop taxpayer bailouts once and for all. I think that's really laughable. I mean, what we're going to need is people that are in power during the next financial crisis that kind of understand the history and know that every cycle that the same things happen over and over again, and that the only way to really bring it into an end is to stop the bailouts, because that just perpetuates it into the future.
Yeah, you know, the irony of the situation is of that we need to pass a law to stop future bailouts when bailouts are already illegal. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government can bail out a private business that fails. So by bailing out companies, we're already breaking the law. And so if Congress is going to break one law, what difference does it make if they pass another one? And of course, you know, it wasn't passed to prevent bailouts. It was basically passed to outline a formula for bailouts.
Well, and if you look at the history again, I mean, it's clear that even if they don't have the power when one of these financial crises come along, they go ahead and pass a bailout. I mean, the RFC in the 30s, that was a new law that was passed then. They made some adjustments to Fannie and Freddie in the 80s when Fannie first failed. That was their first failure, and then this failure in 2008 was their second failure. So, and then obviously they passed the TARP this time around, so they don't need to have a power in place. They always kind of do an ad hoc piece of legislation during these crises that gives them more power and expands the power of these agencies, whether it's Treasury or FDIC or you know, the Fed.
Yeah, I mean, do you think the people that were, you know, the legislature or the guys at the Fed or Treasury, you think they were even looking at any of these prior bailouts to guide what they were doing, or you know, or were they just you know, shooting from the hip?
Well, I think they did look at the RFC in the 1930s, as you know. Chairman Bernanke is a student of the 1930s, but to me, the only lesson that I could glean that he learned from that the Fed was too transparent, because he went off on the fact that the RFC publicized the names of the banks that got money and got funding. So his lesson was, this time around, we're not going to be stupid enough to be secret. I mean, we're not going to be stupid enough to publicize the names. We're just going to be very secretive. And that kind of links to some of the work I've done in bringing a couple lawsuits against the Fed to try to wrest a lot of this information out of them.
I understand that you filed four cases under the Freedom of Information Act to try to get some information behind the decisions. I mean, have you been furnished with any information, or what are the status of those cases?
Well, initially I had a lot of problems. The first go around, the Fed just completely ignored me and didn't send me anything. The FDIC, on the other hand, gave me documents, but they were about 80% whited out. There's one of them I have in the book that you can see, and I compared the pre-whited out redacted version versus what I finally got my hands on.
Where did you get the version that wasn't whited out? What was the source of that?
Well, went along about 2 years at this lawsuit. It started in 2009. In 2011, we were right about to have the judge here in D.C. was going to rule on whether I should get the documents or not, and the FDIC just released it because they didn't want to codify in law anything the judge might have slapped them on the wrist for. So And it was released to me, and then at the same time, it went to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
So what did they white out? Anything particularly damning that they whited out? Or,
well, it's really curious. What I would say they whited out was in an attempt to limit the embarrassment of them of the, in this case, the FDIC. I mean, if you compare the whited out version versus the fully released version, it's just incredible how weak the case is for bailing out in this case, Wachovia. They talk generally about the economy and how bad the economy is, and there's wild speculation about what might happen if Wachovia were to fail, but there's no analysis at all. It's just, you know, this combination of general talk and speculation without any substance about the particular institution that was.
And the thing is, government economists have such a bad track record of forecasting anyway, to say that we're going to bail out a company, we're going to put major taxpayer funding behind a bailout because we think that it'll help the economy, or that we think the economy will be negatively impacted. I mean, it's not up to the government to try to micromanage the economy and try to infuse taxpayer money into private businesses because it thinks that that's what would be good for the economy. I mean, that's what they do in a socialist country. That's not what they're supposed to do in a free market economy.
Well, and this wasn't the first time they had these Chicken Little stories about what bad things would happen. I trace back to the 30s, and there it was a bank called Bank of the United States, and the banking commissioner in New York was saying, well, you know, we can't let Bank of the United States fail because, 10 or 15 banks in New York City are going to fail, blah, blah, blah. And then in Continental, it was the same thing. There was this idea that 66 banks would fail and another 50 of them would be on the brink of it. And that was shown.
We're using they used the word interconnected. I don't know if they used that same terminology back then.
Right. And that was because Continental was a correspondent bank that had all these correspondent relationships with the smaller banks. But during that time, there was testimony, and GAO completely blew away the FDIC's case that these 66 banks would fail and another couple dozen were at risk of failure. And then obviously during the most recent crisis, I dug out a lot of these documents, and there's a lot of big numbers thrown around. You see some spreadsheets, but there's no real connection between the numbers and any other institution that fails.
Well, there rarely are, especially when it's the government and that are coming up with the numbers. You know what they say about liars and figuring. But anyway, hey, thanks for being on the show. It sounds like a real interesting read. The name of the book, again, is Financing Failure, A Century of Bailouts. Thanks, Vernon, for coming on the show. Everybody else, we've got another full hour of the Peter Schiff Show coming up, so make sure and stick around.